Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, Baltimore Sun columnist. And this is Roughly Speaking, episode 339 for Thursday, January 4th, 2018.
To suggest that to cut murders in half is too ambitious is to just not understand how off the charts we have gone and how unacceptable the pace of killings in Baltimore has been these last 3 years.
That is the voice of Thiru Vignaraja, an experienced attorney, a former federal and city prosecutor, who has a plan for cutting Baltimore's annual murder count in half over the next 3 years. That is, if voters elect him over the incumbent state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby. Vignaraja is my guest on today's show. If you live in Baltimore and care about what's happening here in terms of crime, you should hang with us for the next 40 minutes or so and hear what Vignaraja has to say. He's releasing a 5-point plan to cut shootings and homicides, and we'll hear about it in a few minutes. First, some background. Thiru Vignaraja is 41 years old. He grew up in Baltimore and Baltimore County, graduated from Woodlawn High School, attended Yale, then Harvard Law School. He was president of the Harvard Law Review, and he clerked for Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. After that, he was an assistant U.S. attorney in Baltimore, then head of the Major Investigations Unit of the state's attorney's office under Marilyn Mosby's predecessor, Greg Bernstein. Some numbers. In 2011, Bernstein's first year on the job, the city had 197 homicides, the lowest that number had been in two decades. Then, in his second year, the count rose to 217. In 2013, Baltimore recorded 235 homicides. The trend was up, but the annual death toll never reached the dismal levels we have seen since Mosby, who defeated Bernstein in the 2014 city election, took office in early 2015. In each of the last 3 years, homicides have risen above 300 annually. In fact, there have been 143 more homicides in Mosby's 3 years than under Bernstein in four. Thiru Vignaraja blames Mosby for this, just as Mosby blamed Bernstein for the rise in violence during his tenure. Today, Thiru Vignaraja says he has a specific plan to increase successful prosecutions of violent repeat offenders and to cut the city's annual homicide count in half. We just came out of our third consecutive year of 300 or more homicides in Baltimore City. This is really depressing. On January 1st, we had two more homicides. What's going on? Do you have a sense, an understanding from your work in the past and just keeping an eye on things here the last couple of years, why these killings continue?
I mean, it is so heartbreaking. It is so wrenching for everyone. It is affecting every corner of the city. And the explanation is at once both very complicated but also very simple. There are, of course, systemic forces that drive violence in every city, in Baltimore and many other urban centers across the country, a lack of opportunity, a lack of educational opportunities. But there is, I think, over the last 3 years, very specific failings by the state's attorney's office in Baltimore City that explain this sudden, dramatic skyrocketing of murders and shootings after a long period of decline. It wasn't always this way. We were reducing the number of arrests. We were reducing the number of young black men incarcerated for petty offenses, and we were reducing the number of murders and shootings and carjackings and armed robberies. And then all of a sudden, in 2015, 2016, and 2017, and now at the start of 2018, we've seen this sudden dramatic reversal. And I think there are four very specific failures that explain what has happened.
Let's hear them. I once wrote in my column that blaming the state's attorney for Baltimore's homicide problem is much like blaming a cardio surgeon, a heart surgeon, for heart disease.
Yeah. No, I think that there are very specific things that the state's attorney can do. And I, you know, it's tempting to blame the judges, to blame the police, to blame the community, to blame the... I just don't think that's what's explained the sudden reversal. So in the last 3 years, you have seen a massive turnover of prosecutors in that office. Over 100 of the 200 prosecutors in Baltimore City have left in the last 3 years. That is unprecedented. And that has very predictable consequences. The second big failing is that we are just not seeing results in prosecutions in Baltimore City for serious felony crimes. The Baltimore Sun reported that in 2016, of the cases that were sent to trial, that means they didn't plead out in reception court, they were actually sent to trial, only 17% of them resulted in convictions at trial. Some of them were dropped, some of them were pled out at the last minute, some of them resulted in hung juries, and a lot of them resulted in acquittals. But if you're only convicting 17% of the people that are sent to trial, that's a huge problem. You know, one of the things that doesn't get enough attention is the actual number. We're talking about an office of over 200 prosecutors that in total only secured 175 trial convictions in all of 2016 for any felony crime. That's startling. The third failing is specifically to do with gun prosecutions. You know, if you go back all the way back to 2015, there's about 2,700, 2,800 cases that involved guns, felon in possession all the way to murders involving guns that have been resolved. So we can actually look at the data of what happened in those cases. It's really troubling. The state's attorney's office essentially dropped 35% of felony cases involving gun charges. Of the cases that went to trial all the way back to 2015, through this past summer, two-thirds of the cases that were sent to trial resulted in an acquittal on all counts. You can't expect gun violence not to skyrocket if these basic gun cases, felon in possession, carjackings involving guns, robberies involving guns, and certainly shootings and murders involving guns, to have such poor results.
So we're not putting criminals in jail, not enough criminals in jail, given the opportunities that exist to put them in jail.
Yeah, I mean, police are stepping up, community is stepping up, witnesses are stepping up, and charges are being brought. When I mentioned a moment ago that 35% of cases are being dropped, they're actually being dropped on average 6 months after the state's attorney's office is indicting them. So the state's attorney's office is looking at that case, deciding that there's enough, taking it to the grand jury, bringing charges, serious charges against individuals, and then 6 months later, just dropping the case.
What happens there? I mean, you were in that office. What explains that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this has got to all be connected. When I was a federal prosecutor, when you made a decision to take a case to the grand jury and indict it, it was a very serious decision. You had to get approval from your supervisor. You had to write out a memo, and then you brought the case. When I ran the major investigations unit in Baltimore City, we did something very similar. My prosecutors had to submit to me an overview of the case, had to make sure they talked to the witnesses, and then and only then could they take that case into the grand jury and obtain an indictment. But if you've got massive turnover, if you've got massive attrition, you're talking about upper management, middle management, rising stars all leaving the office in close proximity to one another, you've got this massive deficit of training and supervision. And that means those cases are not getting the close look on the front end that they need. And then they're walking into court and they're not ready for what's about to happen. And it's much easier to drop a case and say, oh, I couldn't find the witness, or the police officer didn't show up. Well, if you don't call the police officer a couple days in advance and tell them they're needed for court, that's going to happen. And then there's a fourth failure, which is, I think, a really important one, which is the lack of proactive, complex investigations targeting the gangs and violent drug organizations that are responsible for the lion's share of the shootings and the killings. Federal prosecutors have borne that responsibility almost exclusively. There were 15 RICO-style indictments focused on gangs and violent drug organizations in Baltimore City that were brought by the federal prosecutors.
Over what period are you talking about?
Since 2015.
And RICO refers to the racketeering, federal racketeering law.
That's right. These, you know, multi-defendant cases involving, you know, serious repeat criminals. In my last year in the state's attorney's office, we brought 12 such cases in 2014, multi-defendant complex cases involving drug organizations, violent gangs. They were premised on wiretaps, on undercover operations over the course of a couple of months. In the last 3 years, based on the state's attorney's office's own press releases, I found only one. And those cases used to be the strategy to go after the worst organizations in the most violent neighborhoods in Baltimore.
Guerrilla Family, for instance.
Right? That's right. That's right. And if that strategy, too, is not on the table, and again, those are hard cases. You need veteran prosecutors. You need career prosecutors. You need prosecutors that have the training and supervision and morale to do those hard cases. If that, too, is not being done, that certainly, I think, is a very specific explanation for what's happened. Look, crime is complicated, and there's a lot of things that underlie it. We have to make investments in our juveniles. We have to make investments in our schools. But those factors were there in 2014 and 2013 and 2003, too. So to simply point to the systemic forces that explain lots of problems is to throw your hands up in the air and say, well, I hope things turn around. We can do better, and we can do specific things to turn this around quickly.
You're campaigning on a pledge to bring homicides to a record low in record time. How do you plan to do that?
Yeah, this week, we are unveiling a concrete 5-point plan to cut murders in half in 3 years. You know, the first thing people say when I talk about this at community centers, in church basements, they say, that sounds very ambitious. And the first thing I have to emphasize is it's unfortunately not that ambitious. We were 80% of the way there 3 years ago. If we cut murders in half in Baltimore City, we would be almost as safe as cities like Milwaukee and Oakland. To suggest that to cut murders in half is too ambitious is to just not understand how off the charts we have gone and how unacceptable the pace of killings in Baltimore has been these last 3 years. And there are very specific things that we can do.
Let's go over them. Yeah. You have 5 points that you're announcing?
Yeah, that's right. So the first one connects to those proactive cases that we're talking about. There are 10 neighborhoods in Baltimore City that have had 50 or more homicides and shootings since 2015. These are the most deadly neighborhoods in Baltimore City. And you know a lot of them. It's Park Heights. It's Brooklyn. It's Greenmount East. It's those neighborhoods that have perennially faced this problem. Well, the first thing that prosecutors have to do is to lead complex, long-term investigations at those neighborhoods. This is what we did in Greenmount, where there were 52 homicides and shootings in a 5-block radius right around 24th and Barclay. After a gang prosecution that was brought in November of 2013, we went 18 months without a single homicide, not one.
That was the BGF case?
That's right.
That was Mund Park.
That's right.
M-U-N-D Park is where the BGF hung out. Children couldn't play there because they were using that as, you know, their open-air headquarters, really.
That's exactly right. And for that 18-month period, you saw a relative peace come to that neighborhood. Federal prosecutors did something very similar in Cherry Hill. And it was reported that that neighborhood went 700 days without a single shooting. So we know that these kinds of cases take an investment, they take work, but prosecutors and police and community working together can make a huge difference. That's the first part of the plan. The second part of the plan is that we have to match community policing with community prosecutors. We used to have a prosecutor that would sit down once a month with intel lieutenants, with the major for the Eastern District, and say, who are the individual engines of violence that are driving shootings and killings in this particular district? And they would then match that information with a strategy to try to get them off the streets. I want to reorganize the office around a community prosecution model. So we have prosecutors, misdemeanor, felony, homicide prosecutors that are assigned to the Eastern District. So they start in the Eastern District as a misdemeanor prosecutor. They become a felony prosecutor that gets to know that neighborhood, those organizations, those individuals, as well as the community and police that they work with. I think that's going to be a really important strategy to identify the worst, most dangerous repeat criminals and come up with strategies to take them off
the streets. And that's not something that's in place now.
No, unfortunately, two things have happened. You know, it was reported, it got a lot of press that Ms. Mosby actually fired some of the career community prosecutors in the office because of political disagreements, which is, in my view, unacceptable. And she's organized the office, around drug units and gun units. And each of those make for good news. You get a press release out of it. But it's not the way we should be prosecuting cases in 2018. We got to have a community-based model where prosecutors know those neighborhoods, know those organizations, know those beat cops, and know the intelligence that we need to share every day, every week in those neighborhoods. The third thing we have to do is we have to prioritize certain high-impact prosecutions that can really drive down violent crime, shootings and homicides in particular. You know, there was a really interesting analysis that was done by Justin George a couple years ago that said that Baltimore was the most lethal city in America, that in most cities in America, one in five shootings, one in six shootings ends in death. But in Baltimore, it's one in three, right, even though we've got these great hospitals. And he went and looked at the data, and he figured out why it was happening.
It was headshots, wasn't it?
Well, there's a higher percentage of headshots. There's a higher percentage of high-caliber weapons that were being used. There were a higher average number of casings per crime scene. Mm-hmm. Our killers are literally using bigger bullets, more bullets, and they're killing people with headshots. What I want to do is create dedicated cold case prosecutors to go back and look at some of the murders that remain unsolved and start focusing on those that were likely committed by repeat killers. Because if you are using 40 caliber weapons, high capacity magazines, and firing two bullets in the head, that's not your first killing and it's not your last. Those prosecutions, those cases need to be prioritized. But it's not just the murders. It's also cases like burglaries. You know, over the last 3 years, we've had 23,000 burglaries in Baltimore City. That's an extraordinary number. But one of the other things that's interesting about burglaries from a prosecution and investigation perspective is when individuals commit those burglaries, they leave the kind of forensic evidence that can support a strong prosecution. They leave DNA, they leave fingerprints. And so if you're looking at a burglary case and you've got somebody that was a suspect in a shooting, that was charged in a carjacking, but that case got dropped, but you've got a good burglary on them, that's an opportunity to really make an impact on that particular case. And that too can make a significant difference.
That's common sense. But again, I must ask, that's not something that's in place now?
There's no evidence that it's being done. And part of it is you got to think strategically about which cases to focus on. That requires, this is stuff that we learned by being prosecutors in Baltimore City. This is not rocket science, but it is something that you require some measure of experience to learn. And those three things, you know, focusing on the gangs, focusing on certain individuals, focusing on certain categories of crimes, that requires resources. And so the fourth part of our plan is to really redirect resources away from prosecuting victims of addiction and victims of trafficking for petty offenses and really focus on these more serious categories. Because every time we prosecute someone for loitering or trespass or simple possession, we are making a tacit decision to take resources away from prosecuting carjackings and shootings and burglaries and killings. There are so many victims of addiction that need help. The statistic that a lot of folks cite is that 1 in 10 victims of addiction in Baltimore City are getting the help and resources they need. We know that the drug epidemic has to be addressed through a public health paradigm, not through a criminal justice strategy alone. And if we start taking those individuals that need the help that they desperately want and taking them out of the criminal justice system, that's fewer cases for prosecutors to have to worry about, so they can instead focus on the kinds of cases that everybody is concerned with, these street robberies, these carjackings, these shootings and killings.
And the fifth point of your plan?
The fifth point of the plan requires prosecutors to be really smart about their role in reentry. 73% of the individuals that return to the streets of Baltimore are re-arrested and reincarcerated within 3 years of their release. That was a report or a statistic that was cited in an ABLE study not long ago.
Yeah, it's considerably higher than it is statewide.
That's right. It's about 40% statewide. Yeah. In Baltimore City, it's 73%. We have to be better about that. Now, there's lots of folks that are working on that. The Department of Public Safety, the reentry folks in parole and probation.
Nonprofits are working on it.
That's right. But prosecutors do have an important role to play. What I would want prosecutors to do is to identify, working with police and working with public safety, those individuals who are at greatest risk of being killed or killing someone within a year of their release, and actually going to them 6 months before their release, bringing them into a room and saying, look, we got some good news and we got some bad news. The bad news is you're here because you are at greatest risk of being killed or killing someone else within a few months of your release. The good news is no one in this room wants that to happen. And we want to come up with a comprehensive strategy to make sure you get the drug rehabilitation services, the skills training, the homeless services, the housing opportunities that you need to make sure you have a productive return to society.
Is that a role for a prosecutor? That sounds like parole and probation to me.
I think that there is a really important role for prosecutors to play. When David Kennedy had brought a ceasefire model to Baltimore City, it was prosecutors, police, faith leaders, community activists.
Parole and probation.
That's right. Who would all go into the community, identify individuals that were part of a gang, bring them in, and have a conversation with them and say, we're in this room because we're worried that you're going to commit serious crimes, but we want to try to make sure that never happens. And I think the voice of a prosecutor saying, we're not here because we want to make sure we lock you up again. We want to make sure that you are never one of our defendants again. I think that's a very powerful message that prosecutors can issue, and it's a critical part of making sure that when they get back on the streets, they don't become another statistic, either as a defendant or as a victim.
I must say, it's an interesting idea. It's the ceasefire model, a call-in, so to speak, but takes place behind the walls.
That's exactly right.
Prosecutors work with the police. There's a feeling in Baltimore that the police aren't being as proactive as they were before. We have a consent decree with the Justice Department, which makes them wary about how they carry out their duties. Are you worried about that? Do you worry that the police don't bring the cases, aren't working as hard, are skittish about how they go about their work?
The police department, the police commissioner, the mayor, I think, are the first to acknowledge that there is room for improvement, that there is a need for reform. They were shouting at the top of their lungs, calling for the consent decree because they realized that it was an opportunity to take a hard look and make some much-needed changes within the department. But police officers are working very hard to try to make strong cases. I think that there's always an opportunity for prosecutors to provide more guidance to police on what they can and what they can't do. That kind of relationship marked by mutual respect is one where you say, look, detective, that was not a good stop, and here's what you did wrong, but this case can't go forward. That's a conversation that doesn't have to be antagonistic. It's a conversation that we have as professionals with our colleagues. And it's important for them to come to us and say, look, this is a case that I think is strong enough to charge, and here's why I think that we can take this to court. And those kinds of conversations have to happen. I think at the highest levels, you hear a lot about police and prosecutors trying to work to rebuild that relationship. That is a really important piece of what needs to happen. And I don't know that moving forward, if we sit there and focus on the Freddie Gray debate, if we sit there and focus on the broken relationship between police and prosecutors on both sides from yesteryear, that we're really in a position to move forward. I really think it's important to turn the page. We need experience. We need a proven prosecutor who knows how to build these cases, and this is exactly what I've done.
What about the criticism that police don't make enough arrests? Arrests are way down in terms of sheer numbers.
Yeah, this is important to be clear on. The strategy of zero tolerance and mass incarceration has completely failed. It had made things worse, not better. And in fact, we saw, and this is the best evidence that arrests are not the recipe for bringing violence down, we saw over a decade of reductions, significant reductions in the number of arrests from nearly 100,000 to down to 40,000, even before the Freddie Gray matter happened. And during that period, where arrests were going down steadily year after year, so was crime. So to think that arrests are the way to bring crime down, it just defies a history in Baltimore that proves that that's not the case. We need to make smart arrests. We need to arrest violent repeat offenders. We need to not waste as much time on the arrests of loitering and trespass cases that disproportionately affect communities of color. But there are ways to make sure that we can drive down violent crime without arresting our way out of it.
I had two questions that relate to the first point you made today about the turnover in prosecutors in the state's attorney's office, the number of experienced prosecutors who have left since Marilyn Mosby became state's attorney. First of all, what do you think accounts for that? I know she fired some people, but a lot of people just left. What accounts for that? And then what do you do about it? Because it sounds like you'd have a lot of recruiting to do.
Yeah. You know, I'll leave it to the people that have left to explain their reasons. I have heard that morale is low. that the focus on the celebrity status of the office instead of on the hard, noble work of prosecutors has been a source of frustration. I know that the firings that appear to be politically motivated made people look over their shoulders and think this is not what prosecutors have ever been. They're supposed to be separate from politics, not beholden to politicians. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do going forward. We need to build a world-class office of prosecutors. And what I would look to is what we did, what others did in New York City. Robert Morgenthau was the legendary DA of Manhattan. And he built, you know, what I think a lot of folks consider the greatest DA's office in American history. And the way he did it was he said, come work here. You work 100 hours a week for a dime on the dollar, and you will love every moment of it because you're going to be working on the most important, hardest cases, and you will get more trial experience in 4 years in Manhattan than you will for the rest of your career once you leave. This ought to be a job that people cherish and chase after out of law school. It was wonderful work. It was the greatest job I've ever had, and I think that it is not a hard sell to get a generation of trial lawyers to come to Baltimore City, knowing that it doesn't pay well, knowing that it's long hours and hard work, but there is something extraordinarily noble about the work that prosecutors can do at its best. And I think that's a pitch that I want to make to lawyers young and old from across the country and right here in Baltimore.
There are a lot of very good attorneys who came out of the state's attorney's office, some that went on to federal prosecution or private practice, some that went on to judgeships.
That's exactly right.
So I have a Freddie Gray question. What would you have done in that situation when you look back on the Freddie Gray prosecutions of police officers, the announcement by the state's attorney, and then the trials that we went through in the city? What are your reflections on all that, and what would you have done?
I think it's a mistake to try to second-guess a prosecutor's decision on any particular case. You don't know what the team knew at a particular moment, what kind of pressures the team faced at a particular juncture. But what I can tell you is this, and I hope this is an answer to the question. If you are thinking about bringing a complex prosecution against six co-defendants involving murder charges premised on a novel legal theory, I just don't think you can do that in 8 or 9 days. I've worked complex cases. I've built these tricky cases against serious defendants. It requires hard work. It requires you to dot your I's and cross your T's. And we're in a position now where it's very hard to look back and understand what could have been done with that case. I think going forward, we have to understand that, you know, the folks that defend the police without equivocation are on one extreme, and the folks that defend Ms. Mosby without equivocation are on the other extreme. I think the answer is more complicated than that. When people say, well, at least the prosecution stopped the riots, I think my answer is that's not something that the state's attorney alone is supposed to do. I think what I would have done if I feared that is I would have taken perhaps the steps of the war memorial, but I wouldn't have done it alone. I would have had the mayor and the police commissioner. I would have had faith leaders and community activists on the stage with me saying, listen, we need peace. We need your patience because I want to do this right. I want to get to the bottom of this. And if there's evidence to support a prosecution, I will bring that case and I will handle it myself. And if there isn't evidence to support a prosecution, you will hear that from me too. And I will explain it in as plain terms as I possibly can. But in the meantime, let us not rush to judgment. Let us not compromise the integrity of this investigation for the sake of trying to keep the peace. That's not what prosecutors have ever been asked to do, and that's not what should have been done in this case.
One last question. I see the word transparency come up in your campaign literature. People running for office, people in office talk about transparency a lot. What does that mean when it comes to the chief prosecutor's office for Baltimore City, the state's attorney's office? Because so much of your deliberations have to be done in secret, you know, grand juries and investigations. And so what do you mean by transparency?
Let me give a couple of examples. One is I want the community to know exactly what my priorities are, how I'm going to measure success, and how I'm doing. So every couple months, we're going to put out a 100-day plan that says this is what we intend to accomplish in the next 100 days. And at the end of 100 days, you're going to see a report that says here's what we've accomplished. You're going to see on our website, accessible to all, how we're doing on every case that is being prosecuted in circuit court in Baltimore City. But it's more than that. It's also about making sure that on the really serious investigations, that there is access to know what is happening on a regular basis. One of the most interesting things that came out of the Freddie Gray case, to talk about that for just another minute, is that the Baltimore Sun actually embedded a reporter, Justin George, in the course of that investigation. Mm-hmm. I am committed to making sure that a member of the press is invited to every police-involved investigation that happens in Baltimore City. I think it's really important to have a measure of public accountability for those kinds of cases, and I think that's what transparency means. It means not that you're going to know which witnesses we're putting in the grand jury or what our deliberations are and which charges to bring, but rather what our goals are, what our metrics are, and how we're doing and why we're doing it. I think that the public is entitled to that, not just when it's election season, but every day, every week, every month, every year.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thiru Vignaraja is a former Deputy Attorney General of Maryland, former Assistant State's Attorney, and former Assistant U.S. Attorney in Baltimore. He is among challengers of Marilyn Mosby for the Democratic nomination for State's Attorney of Baltimore in the June primary. Ms. Mosby and other candidates are invited to join us on the podcast as well. You can find links to the Sun stories Mr. Vignaraja mentioned in the notes with this podcast, as well as a link to his campaign website and that 5-point plan for cutting the city's murder rate that he described in the interview. And that's our show for now. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.